Hi, I'm Reagan, and thanks for listening to my dad's podcast, Lasting Learning.
Welcome to Lasting Learning, the podcast that was started because I thought I had things to say. The podcast that continues to grow because we've learned that your stories matter more. Welcome to Lasting Learning, where we explore great people doing extraordinary things, sharing with us the lasting lessons they've learned along the way. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. You know, one of my favorite things about this podcast is being able to introduce people to brand new people. People that they might not have in their immediate sphere yet, but hopefully people that are going to sink into their orbit, that are going to be a contact to them, that they're going to feel like is a new friend, a family friend, a professional friend, a personal friend, a confidant, somebody that they can learn from and that they can lean into. And I think that today's guest is going to become one of those people for all of you. Today, I've got a guest on who I've been studying and examining and exploring and doing a deep dive on now for literally months, because she is doing some amazing work. She did amazing work over the last couple of decades. She continues to do amazing work today. She is transforming school systems. She's transforming school buildings. She's transforming school buildings. She's taking people and changing their mindsets to change their practices. She's unpacking a lot of our old baggage so that we can do a lot of critical reflection, so that we can look ourselves in the mirror and say, how can I be even better than I was? Her goal is to help individuals become better. Her goal is to knock down walls and eliminate those barriers, to provide opportunities where historically they haven't been. Today, our guest is a woman who's done amazing work around the Northeast of the United States, but her impact is now starting to trickle all around North America as her words change lives. And today, I'm excited to introduce you to Nadia Bennett. Nadia, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, and such a kind intro. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It rings true. As I continue to read the stuff that you're doing, and I continue to listen to graduation speeches and listen to your talks and the things that you're doing, you're transforming me. Slowly but slowly, you're planting those seeds that are allowing me to reflect and question my practices, my beliefs, my biases, and it's helping me grow, and I know that you're going to help others grow today as well. So do you mind introducing yourself, other than the intro that I just shared? Can you give us some actual details about who you are, what you've done, and what led you to this point today?
Sure. Well, I am a CEO and founder of When Brown Girls Lead, an education consulting firm that's focused on creating safe spaces for K-12 school leaders, leaders of all genders, all races, et cetera. I coach principals. I help schools to build anti-racist school environments. And really, my passion is to help people of color feel psychologically safe, right? Help them to feel included, help schools and districts to have appropriate diversity, and to give more Black and brown people, the opportunity to lead, because I do know, and research shows, that school communities thrive when there are more leaders and teachers that look like the children that they're serving, right? So in doing that work, I work with everybody, right? I work with everyone. If you were a superintendent of schools and you said, Nadia, I believe in what you're doing and I wanna bring more diversity, I wanna do a better job of serving the Black and brown children that I lead, I would say, absolutely. I can't wait to jump in and join you. And then we would have a strategic plan on how to bring more diversity, how to have culturally relevant pedagogy in your curriculum, how to unlearn the biases that have been taught to us through the systems in this country. There's a long list of things and touch points that I go through with leaders and individuals that want to grow in their racial consciousness.
Okay, this is gonna be a fun conversation to have. And again, I love what you're doing because you're challenging me. And I know that there are some listeners that are listening to this that are saying, okay, this is so good. I'm glad that this is still a conversation that's out there. This was in vogue 3 years ago, right? When everybody was out there doing their marches and their protests and saying, this is the conversation. And then it just fell off the map and everybody kind of went back to doing the work they've always been doing. But as I speak to you, for those people that are just listening, who have never seen me, who have never seen YouTube videos of me or anything like that, let me just describe who I am real quick.
Okay.
I am a 45-year-old white man living in Florida. Okay. 45-year-old white man. So just that right there sets up for an interesting conversation we're about to have. So let me throw some things out there that I know some other people might be thinking. We're just going to jump right to it. And then we'll start unpacking the actual work. There are some people that might be thinking, especially people that look like me, some people that live near me that might be thinking, really, is it really different? How does the color of your skin impact your ability to lead? Why does a leader have to adjust their leadership styles based off of the color of the kid's skin in which they lead? And Dave, if you started a business that was titled Helping White Men Lead, you would be crucified. So why is it different for you, Nadia?
Well, it's different. Let's start with the children.
Yeah.
Right. I heard Viola Davis say this recently, and I thought she articulated it so well. She said that people deserve to see a representation of their future manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
Say that one more time, a representation of their future manifestation. Black and brown children deserve to see people in authority positions, be it teacher, principal, superintendent, et cetera, because it shows them the possibilities for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We oftentimes in this country, I shouldn't say we, but the systems in this country, oftentimes they show Black and brown children the exact opposite. They show Black and brown children in inferior positions. They show them in negative positions. Right. And so if you are a child, and particularly if you're between the ages of birth and about 7 years old, where the brain is like a sponge and is soaking up everything, and everybody that you see that looks like you is not in a healthy or thriving place in life, you're going to begin to believe some things about yourself. Mm-hmm. And so when we're not intentional about representation, we are unconsciously, one could say unintentionally, maintaining white supremacy and Black inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
And the children just simply don't deserve that. They did nothing in this world, but they were born, right? And so if we want to see change as the country is changing, that's a part that representation really does matter. And there's a lot of research that says representation is good for not only Black and brown children, but for all children.
Mm-hmm.
White children benefit from seeing strong representation, right? Because you're sending, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, in the last US census, less than 50% of school-age children identified as white alone. That's the first time that's ever happened in American history. The world is changing. This country is changing. And so you have a choice as a parent, as a school leader. Do you want to set your young child up for a world that they're not going to be prepared for because they don't know diversity, they don't know representation? Because when they're adults, this country is going to be a different place.
Mm.
So that's one thing. And then when you mention, well, why does it need to change because of someone's skin color? Well, let's shift that a little bit, and not so much skin color, but culture. So different races have different cultures. And everything that we see, as someone, I was born and raised in this country. I'm a Black woman who was born and raised in America. Everything that I saw growing up, media, books, school, whatever, it was all steeped in white culture. Our education, our books, everything is steeped in white culture, right? And so when the systems, the people, everything that we're interacting with on a daily basis does nothing to acknowledge different cultures, we're doing the children a disservice. And I'm not talking about culture on the surface level where, you know, when it's Hispanic Heritage Month, we, you know, cook Mexican food and wear sombreros. First of all, that's a little bit disrespectful, but that's what schools do. I'm talking about going a bit deeper and even understanding how different cultures define kinship, how different cultures define spirituality. Not to label one or the other good or bad, but to label them different, because we are different, right? And differences are actually good. And so acknowledging that, okay, I'm not just, when our school system was created, it was created for white men. It was not created for women. It was not created for people with disabilities. It was not created for people of color. We're in a very different place in this country, and it's time to make that shift. We'll talk about Florida in a second, but we got to make, I didn't know you were in Florida. That makes a conversation.
Yeah, I try not to advertise that much unless I'm sitting on the beach somewhere. That's the part of Florida I try to associate with. So I'm going to continue to poke a little bit just so we can try to level the playing field. So those people that are listening and thinking that they see the world through their own lens and their lens is the right lens, we can try to just get to an equal mm-hmm. ground here. So with that mindset, and these are some of the things that I've heard over the last 3, 4, 5 years as conversations have trickled up, that the idea of putting leaders in front of kids so they can see their manifestations or their manifest futures, I think that that's completely appropriate. That makes a lot of sense. And I've heard that quotation as well. And I think it's powerful. Mm-hmm. With that logic, then, would it make sense in rural communities, in agricultural communities, to make sure that all the leaders are white men who maybe used to work in the farms, in the suburbs, to have whatever the dominant demographic is in that suburban community be the leadership? And then do we just look for leaders that fit the mold of the majority in whatever community that we're serving?
That's a really great question. So this is what I encourage leaders to do. When they're thinking about their staff and diversity, you want your staff, your teaching staff and your leadership staff to, at a minimum, represent your student body. That's the minimum, okay? So if you're in a rural community and let's say 70% of the students are white and, you know, 20% are students of color, at a minimum, 20% of your teaching staff and 20% of your leadership staff should be people of color. That's the one thing that you can do for the Black and brown children that you serve, right? Mm-hmm. And so to build on that a bit more, though, I don't want us to overlook the fact that right now, the superintendent position, the principal positions in this country are still overwhelmingly white. I think that sometimes people, because there are conversations and there is a mission for more people of color to be that representation for children, that people think that, oh, people of color are taking over. Let's be clear. As of the 2020 superintendent survey, 1.4% of superintendents identify as Black and female. Mm-hmm. Overall Black male or female is less than 4%. The superintendency is still more than 70% white males. It just in the last 10 years has it grown from 13% female to 26% female, right? Mm. The majority of them are white women. Principal position, still 70% of principals. And we know that white women are the majority of teachers. Mm. So I don't want people to get confused about the fact that like the numbers are going to be skewed heavily in one direction. Right now, as the numbers stand in the history, there's still plenty of room for diversity and everybody still be represented and seen.
And I would argue that those statistics are true outside of education as well. We see those same statistics in politics. Yes. We see them in corporate America with CEOs and COOs. We see them in the financial industry. We see it in the medical industry. We see those same sorts of statistics, which is why there's such a push to change the systems. I've also heard people speaking of systems that say things like, I am not racist. So if I'm not racist, how can the system be racist? I don't know anybody that's racist. I don't work with anybody that's racist. And because I'm not, that means the system can't be racist.
Well, that's funny to me because, well, let me say this. I hear that a lot. So there are a couple of things that people have to understand. All of the major systems in this country were created and built on institutionalized racism. Mm-hmm. What do I mean when I say major systems? The education system, the health system, the prison system, all of those, if we think about when those systems were instituted, they were at times when Black people were sometimes were only considered, you know, 3/5 of a person. Can we just pause right there that there was a time in this country's history where me as a full human being, a Black woman looking at you right now, I was only considered 3/5 of a person, right? And so every system that we still live by and operate on today, it was built at a time where Black people's voices, I mean, Black women definitely couldn't vote. Like we couldn't, like there were so many things that we still were not able to do, and we're still living and operating off those systems today. So you may not wake up in the morning as a white man saying the N-word. However, if you go to work and you work within a system that was built on racism and you're perpetuating that, you are a part of the problem. And so we've come to a time where it's not enough to just say, I'm not racist. One has to be intentional about saying, I'm going to be anti-racist. And being anti-racist means I'm going to support policies that support anti-racist decisions, right? I'm going to support decisions that are anti-racist. I'm going to take action against it. And so sticking with that example of someone who doesn't wake up saying the N-word, they may not have been intentionally unkind to a person of color ever in their lives. Thank you. That's nice. However, when you go to work and you sit at your boardroom table, everybody at the table are the only people that look like you, right? If you're at the front, top of a table and it's only white men around you, maybe a couple of white women to, you know, sue the feminist movement, are you really doing everything that you can?
So how do we address that, right? Without identifying people to play the part of a token, right? So I'm sitting around a boardroom and I do look around me and I recognize that everybody in this room looks like me. They talk like me. They think like me. And I say, I need to try to fix this. So is the answer, I need to just go pluck up a Black woman to sit at the table with us so that I can feel better about myself?
Absolutely not. The first thing you need to do is do your work. Mm. Right? Because if you go out there and you hire a token Black woman, that person is going to know that they're a token and they won't stay very long. Because when you don't do your work, you will say and you will do things that imply tokenism. And if that woman knows her worth, no matter what the skill set, no matter how great the opportunity, she won't stick around long. And so start by, when I say do your work, ask yourself, well, why is it that everybody around the table looks like me and talks like me? Why? When did that happen and why is that happening, right? And if you ask yourself why enough times, you're going to get down to the root. And the root might be, well, you know, maybe it's that everyone in my HR department is also white and looks like me and talks like me. And so when they are recruiting, their natural in-group bias is coming into play and they're recruiting people that look like them. And so therefore they're perpetuating X system. Maybe it's because we don't have conversations about race, right? And so we don't have conversations about race, then it never comes up and everybody just stays in their places of comfort, right? Maybe it's we're hiding behind what you just said, I'm not racist. And that's this is another one I hear a lot, I don't see color. For anybody out there that's still saying that term, that is one of the most racist things that you can say. Why? Because if you don't see color, you don't see me. Mm-hmm. I am a person of color. And being that in this country, white culture, white mindset, race is the dominant race. When you don't see color, you're just perpetuating and pushing more of who you are off on me because you are the dominant race in this particular country.
Mm. It's powerful. So I'm going to tell you a little story about my own personal walk, and then I'm going to have you give me something tactical that I can do if that's possible, right? So I spent the majority of my adult life living in the suburban area around Detroit, Michigan. So the Metro Detroit area is, according to the last census, the most segregated area in the United States. People don't necessarily recognize that every suburb has its own demographic cultural majority, whether it's Arabic or Hispanic or Black or white, every suburb has its own identity. Back in 2020, I read White Fragility. I mean, I even took my little selfie sitting by the pool reading it so the world could know that I was doing my work, right? Mm-hmm. That summer, I walked in some marches and I brought my kids with me. I even took the selfies to show that I, Dave Schmidto, this white guy, was bringing his kids and we were walking in the protest marches. I then moved to Florida. And now in Florida, I live in my little gated community. It's amazing. My kids go to the public schools, but just recently our school district decided that they were closing one of the buildings. And those kids, I'm using air quotes, are now being split up. And those kids are now coming to my kids' school. And the conversations in my gated community is, should we be taking our kids out of that school then and placing them somewhere else? Because those kids are coming here now. Do we need to take our kids to private school? And I had some very real conversations with people just this last summer about where should our kids go to school. And it's interesting because I look at myself and say, no, I did the work. I took the selfies with the reading the book. I took the selfies doing the march. I consider myself to be engaged in the right conversations. But then when I start thinking about those kids coming to school with my kids, I'm not racist, but ooh, what do I need to do? I mean, are my kids still safe? Are we going to be watering down the education? Like, those are very real thoughts and very transparent thoughts from this mid-40s white guy talking that I know other people are having. And they'll say, well, it's not about race. It's about values. It's about culture. But come on, it's a racial conversation that people are having. It's a systemic issue where even the fact that we have those kids in that school and these kids in this school, based off of the neighborhoods and the zoning, there are some serious issues that we have to address. Is some of the work that I need to do simply looking myself in the mirror and saying, why do I feel uncomfortable? Why am I even questioning whether or not that school is going to be good enough for me? Is it, do I now need to make decisions saying my kids are going to stay put no matter what? Talk to me about on a very personal level, and then we can talk through how to actually start to transform individuals and empower the kids, yes, and the future leaders.
So the questions that you asked towards, first of all, thank you for sharing that. And the questions that you asked towards the end are some really good questions to start. What are you afraid of? Hmm. What have you believed about Black and brown children that makes you wonder if you should take your children out of the school? Mm-hmm. And when you can honestly answer that question, then I think that you're on a path to some. So if a person were to really ask themselves that question and say, well, what have I believed? Well, I have believed that Black and brown children are not as intelligent as white children. I have believed that Black and brown children are violent. I have believed that they are ignorant. I have believed that my children will suffer harm. I have believed that when Black people come into a neighborhood, Black or brown people come into a neighborhood, then the housing value goes down, right? Mm-hmm. And well, now I ask you, well, where did these beliefs come from? What evidence have I seen, right? What have I actually seen for myself that makes any of these things true?
Yeah.
And then you can do some research because there are plenty of books. So do we live in a place still that perpetuates all of these negative stereotypes about Black people? Yes, but it's your choice as a grown person, mm-hmm, in the information age to research and find out for yourself. Understand that every time you put on a TV, you put on a movie, there's intentionality about how certain groups are depicted, and that's intentional. Mm-hmm. If you've never had a conversation with a Black person, if you have never been in community with Black people or brown people to understand them, to understand their values, that values one. When people say it's a, that's almost funny to me, because to assume that people of color have lesser values, mm-hmm, it's like, wow, like these are the conversations that are happening behind closed doors because the values are different, mm-hmm, maybe, right? And so when you begin to ask yourself and answer some really honest questions, and when you mentioned at the beginning that, oh, you read White Fragility, then you did the on-surface things. You didn't really do your work. Mm-hmm. If you are still clenching and getting uncomfortable and nervous about Black and brown children coming into a district, then you didn't really do the work. You did the things that were, like I said, on-surface, particularly after the murder of George Floyd. Everybody was jumping on board. We stand for George Floyd. We do this, we do that, da, da, da. But did you really do that inner transformative work? I would say you did not. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself, what am I afraid of? Yeah. What have I believed about Black and brown children that makes me afraid of them? I can, for the record, we all have biases. And I can choose to believe things that I have seen, experienced, that are with white men that would have stopped me from having this conversation with you.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I share my story because I think it's a story that represents where a lot of people are, right? Yeah. They think that they did the performative work. They have the quotes, they took the selfies, but they haven't done the work. And I know that that's the reality because white flight is still in place in America today. It's not something from the 1950s and 60s. It still exists. It exists in subtle ways and sometimes in extremely obvious ways, but it still exists. And, you know, when I mentioned that I live in Florida, that causes a certain reaction from some people. If I would have said I live in Texas, it would have caused a certain reaction because those are realities in a lot of places where I live or where others live. And when we talk about individuals versus systemic racism, this is part of what we're talking about, where there are practices in place that perpetuate systemic issues for people. And yep, it might be based off of race, but they also take place based off of gender, based off of age, based off of a lot of contributing factors. The work that you're doing focuses both on race and gender and other issues, right? And for people to say that doesn't exist anymore, you're living back in the 40s and 50s and 60s. You talk about TV shows and the perpetuation of a belief and myth. Let's just take race off the equation. When was the last time you watched a sitcom on TV? Well, first of all, when was the last time anybody watched a sitcom? But when was the last time you watched a sitcom on TV and they presented the husband as being anything other than a blubbering buffoon, right? It perpetuates the myth that dads are supposed to be these gullible behemoths that can't make intelligent decisions. And it's those sorts of things. But yep. we do it all the time with the stereotypes and the caricatures that we portray people to be. And then subliminally, we start to believe that's the reality. Go ahead.
No, I would to kind of build on that example that you just gave, even around like the absence of Black fathers.
Yes.
Or Black fathers are not in the home, which there's recent research that has come out, which I would encourage people to look this up. But there's recent research that says like Black fathers are actually more involved with their children than any other race. In terms of being in the household, sitting down, having dinner with their children, bringing them to sports, et cetera. Literally, like, but media, people have to, like, this is why I've said in the beginning that every system in this country was built on institutionalized racism, but then also perpetuating it,
yes.
Right? Same thing goes for the media. They have I think we all know that media has an agenda. And when they have an agenda, they're going to push that agenda. And they've been doing that for hundreds of years. And so it's a person, it's an adult's choice to remain in their own ignorance. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when you mentioned that you're in Florida earlier, I could have, as a Black woman, as anti-racist work. When you mentioned Florida, I could have immediately said, oh my gosh, why did I sign up to do this podcast?
Well, you probably thought it. It's okay.
Right. How do I get myself out of this situation as quickly as possible? But when one becomes anti-racist, that is a phenomenal example of someone who has done their work and says, I could take on the belief about Floridians, right? And just believe that Dave, is aligned with those beliefs, or I can listen and understand him and see what he's about.
Fair enough. But whatever it's worth, I live in the area of Florida that we typically call fake Florida. I'm way up in the panhandle. The crazy people are way down south. So it's okay. I'll be real. I'm not one of those.
I got you. That's hilarious. But yeah, people have to ask themselves what I'm afraid of. And I believe it was Eleanor Roosevelt that said something to the effect of we must do the thing that we're afraid to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And when we start facing those fears, then we can begin to see that transformation.
That's good. And so part of your work also deals with gender stereotypes and empowering women to step up and be leaders. And that's a whole nother level of interest to me, right? Because I know that there are some men out there that get extremely intimidated. They might not even articulate it or might not even say it, but they get intimidated when they have to, quote unquote, work for a woman. And there are women that feel the bias of when they're a leader, they are presented as either soft or a B word, right? Or they have to play that game. There are women that fall into the trap of, I either have to be a stay-at-home mom or I have to go out and change the world. And there are these camps and these perceptions that you have to try to overcome constantly. And you're tackling both of these worlds. You're tackling gender and race and saying, I am empowering, encouraging, and equipping women of color to go out and transform the world. I mean, that's huge. That is huge work. That number one, you're trying to equip the individuals to go change the system, even knowing that the system around these individuals kind of has created a stacked deck against them. So talk to me about that work that you do.
Well, I'm a person, I will tell you how I started. I'm a person that is very passionate, very, very passionate. And that passion, depending upon the environment, can come off as, it can come off as an articulate, passionate person, or it can come off as like, all right, you got one more time before I turn something over. And so the passion behind, so my own story, I've shared with, a bit about like having been a teacher, and I know what it feels like to be the only Black teacher on my teaching team, which is uncomfortable. As an assistant principal, I was the only Black woman over instruction, because there was a belief that when Black people were hired in that particular organization, that they were always placed in roles to discipline Black children, and that there was, that the white leaders were better at the intellectual work. I was, like I said, that district at the time served probably about 10,000 or more young people. The majority of the young people were Black and brown, yet there was a prevailing belief that the white people should be leading instruction. And then I got into that role and I doubled academic numbers. And then I got my respect, which is, I say that with frustration, because I even had to earn the respect. Because when I came in, I used to say this to my leaders all the time, when white people are hired in these, white men particularly, are hired in these positions, there is an excitement and eagerness of like, this person is going to do great work. When a Black woman is hired, it's like, oh, let's see how this goes. Mm. Whether people want to believe that or not, we are still required to prove ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so once I proved myself, shortly after that, I became the high school principal. And then I turned that space around, right? Academically, behavior-wise, state numbers, et cetera, all of the above. Then got recruited to be an executive director for all intents and purposes. I was a charter superintendent, did the same thing there, turned it all around. That's when my eyes were opened more than any other place to the intersectionality of race and gender. Mm. Because that particular district, all of the majority of the men on the board that I worked with were white males over the age of 50. Mm. And there was another, and the other chiefs were male, and there was one other woman, and she was white. And that was the time when I experienced more than any other time in my life, like a forced smallness. Mm-hmm. Like, we want your skill set. We know your track record. We know you're good. We want you to come in here and do what you did at that other district, but make sure you keep us comfortable when you do it.
Wow.
Make sure that we, as the white men leading this organization, always, our egos always feel reassured, right? Don't be too smart. Be smart, but don't be too smart. Be strategic, but don't be too strategic, right? And it's this space of, well, I have to literally turn schools around. I have to meet state standards and federal standards, and all this work is on my back, while at the same time making sure that my white male counterparts feel comfortable about the work that I'm doing. Mm. And it was a double tax on me. I would even say maybe even a triple tax, in that, like, just the work of being a turnaround school leader on top of being Black, on top of being female. It was, I got to a point where it's like, I cannot do this anymore. And I got tired of people wanting my skill, wanting my intelligence, but wanting nothing else of me, not wanting my culture, not wanting the wholeness of who I am and what I bring to the table. Like I said, get stronger academic numbers, make us look good to the state, but leave that race talk outside of the door. Leave that gender talk outside of the door.
First of all, thank you for sharing such a personal story. It's a different perspective than one that I'm equipped to with, and something that I haven't experienced. Right, I've had jobs that are very similar to yours, and when I've been hired to do my jobs, I've had the feeling of don't fail. In your jobs, it was not don't fail; it was you better win. In my jobs, it was, you need to be the smartest one in the room. In your job, it's been get the job done, but make us feel like we're smarter than you. And I can't imagine that dynamic of, so in my jobs, don't fail, but yet still be the smartest person. In your job, you better win, but you better not be the smartest, most divergent thinker. Continue to perpetuate the status quo, but better get different results. Like that dichotomy, I feel it. And now that you're articulating it, I've seen it, but I've never quite heard that story told as you just told it. So I appreciate you sharing that. And it got you to this place where you said, I've got to fix this. I've got to do something about this, because nobody else deserves to feel how I feel. I want to get other people in a position to succeed and equip them with the skills to succeed, knowing full well that this is what they're going to step into.
Well, I also, let me say two things. Before even that, it got me to a place where I said, I need to rest. And that's important to lift up, because I'd been turning around schools for, at that time, 10 or 12 years, I think. And I was tired. The last couple of years that I turned around schools, it was during the pandemic. So you can imagine, turn around and the pandemic on top of that, right? And so I had gotten tired and said, well, I'm just going to take a break, right? I think that that's important to acknowledge, because when people don't understand the double or triple tax that people of color and women carry in the workforce, they don't understand that it's a different kind of tired, right? It's an emotional exhaustion. It's a psychological exhaustion. It's a constant requirement of, like, how do I play the game, right? So you may come home from work, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you may come home from work and be physically tired, right? Just because you worked so many hours and there's so much going on, et cetera. And you have to navigate, all right, how do I, like, turn off work and be a dad, right? Women, it's so much more than being physically tired. It is, how do I maintain a sense of self? How do I continue to do this work? How do I not let this work completely burn me out and step away from spaces where I'm needed the most? So it actually just started with, I need a break, right? And then me needing a break turned into, I want to do my part. And the one change I would make in how you describe the part that the role that I play in what I do now is, I want to make it different for Black women coming behind me, right? I don't want to just equip them to be able to handle it. No, I want to make it different, which is why I tell people all the time, I will, as long as the superintendency, principal roles, et cetera, are overwhelmingly white and male, I'm going to have as many conversations with white males in those leadership positions as possible. Why? Because you have the ability to create the change. If I can help you understand the experience of Black women, then I can help you begin to formulate a plan to create that change, right? And so I don't want them to have to go through what I went through. I just want them to release some of the things in their backpack and just be able to come to work and live in that joy of being a person with an excellent skill set that has a lot to bring to the table and just thrive in the work, as opposed to carrying all that taxation of being a person of color and a woman.
Mm. So how do you do that? So I've learned the hard way that you don't necessarily change people's minds by slapping them across the face. You don't change people's emotions by presenting them with logic. You don't change logical people with presenting them with emotions. You oftentimes don't get to see the manifestation of the seeds that you plant, but you're ultimately hoping to change people's actions by changing their minds and their beliefs. You know, when you speak with people that found success as a result of a system that is rigged for their success, it's difficult for them to open up and say, no, I could have gotten this if I looked different, if I was different. If I, for example, myself, I was a building administrator. I was a district administrator. I was a superintendent. I was a college professor. And I now can look back and say, I probably had some advantages being a white male pursuing those opportunities. 5, 10, 15 years ago, I would have refuted that statement. I would have said, no, it's because of my hard work, my grit, my tenacity. I got myself to the situation, right? And I would imagine that that is hard work to have other people look themselves in the mirror and recognize that they're in their positions in part, small part, big part, whatever part, because of the systems. And yet you're trying to get them to look in the mirror and say, we need to change the systems. The same systems that helped you be successful, we have to try to upend a little bit. That's hard. Those are hard conversations to have.
It's very hard. And it's where a lot of people's, white people, it's where a lot of their fear comes from.
Yeah.
Because, and I've outright heard white people say, yes, I know these systems exist, but like they benefit me and they're going to benefit my children. And so mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I want this to happen to you. I'm saying that I recognize that I benefit from it. So I don't know what to do with that. That's a that's a very like scarcity mindset in terms of people believing that, well, can both of us be successful? Yes.
Yeah.
There's enough space for anyone that is called to a certain work and called to a certain skill set. Yes, we can all be successful. That's number one. Number two, I think that morally and ethically, for a person to be aware that they're given privileges based upon something that we cannot control, a social construct that was developed for the very purposes that we're speaking about, I'm not sure how a person could come into a place of awareness about that and feel good morally. I don't know how, I genuinely do not know how someone can do that. How can you know that you are benefiting from a system of oppression that's harming millions of other people just so that you can feel safe? I struggle with that. And if you can offer anything to me to help me to understand that, I will accept it, but I struggle with that.
Well, I think what you're modeling right now, first of all, it's just this genuine curiosity, and you're helping me kind of get inside of your own head and your own thoughts through this conversation. I know some of the work that you do is you offer up leadership coaching to people, which is different than leadership consulting, right? Where you're saying, follow these bullet points. It's coaching. I want to stand beside you, figure out where you are, and help you make some of those pivotal next steps. And knowing that, yes, you want to equip quote unquote brown girls to succeed and become leaders, you're also hoping to change established leaders to change the system, as you said. And I kind of feel like I'm going through a coaching cycle with you, where you're asking some of those critical questions and you're causing me to pause and think about how my beliefs and my actions, my decisions might impact somebody like you as well as somebody like me. Is this what a typical coaching session with you feels like?
Yeah, I'm good for a great probing question. I'm good. Well, because I believe that when going back to your original question, you mentioned like, how do you do that? I first have to know you. Like you just said, I have to understand you. I have to understand who you are as a person, what you believe as a person, and give value to that. Like, I can't coach you if I don't see the value that you bring to the table, if I don't see the intelligence, the passion, the grit, et cetera, that you bring to the table. How can I coach you, right? Mm-hmm. And so that relationship aspect of this is incredibly important. And then it's a matter of, like you said, I often don't see the manifestation, of the work that I do, but I can rest well at night knowing that I've planted the right seeds, knowing that I've worked with the right people. And that's when I'm doing just like large group professional development. However, when I'm working one-on-one, like I have principals that I coach for a full school year, I do get to see some of that, right? I've gone into schools where, you know, Black and brown children are suspended seven times more than their white and Asian counterparts. That's even higher than the national average. And when I realized that some leaders either never look at that data or they don't really deep dive into the data. So they might know that the suspensions are happening. They may not say, okay, well, why are Black children being suspended? And then when you look at it, you might see that the majority of the suspensions are due to disrespect. Well, disrespect is subjective, right? And so how are we defining disrespect? I read something recently. It's a great book by, it's called Push Out. It's about the Black girls being suspended at higher rates and them being criminalized in schools. And she was speaking to the fact that, I want to make sure that I state this correctly, Black girls in schools are judged and suspended based upon white middle-class standards of femininity.
Mm.
Right? In that, however white culture has decided that middle school girls should behave and carry themselves, if a Black girl is not acting and behaving in that exact way, then it's determined to be disrespect or et cetera.
Mm.
In a recent professional development that I led, I said, well, now what if that was flipped around? So something that's big in Black churches is a call and response, right? And where the pastor would say something and the congregation respond. I am a person, so I love all types of music. I have been to concerts where the majority of people are Black, and I've been to concerts where the majority of people are white. Huge eye opener for me, because when I went to that concert with the majority of people are white, I was like, why is everybody sitting down? Why is no one saying anything? I am so confused, right? And this was like 10, 15 years ago. I'm telling you, I left with the biggest, but again, it was great for me because it was an eye opener. Again, the differences in culture. One's not right, which is different. So going back to my example of the call and response in church, that's something that probably every Black child is familiar with that, right? Now, if white middle school girls were judged off of Black culture and the teacher did a call and response and that white students were not responding, that could be deemed disrespectful.
Hmm.
Now, would that be fair to that white girl? No, she's just not familiar with the culture. And so I gave that example for the majority of the teachers in this particular school, they were white and the majority of the leaders were white. So I gave that example of how unfair it is to be a 12-year-old girl and just not be familiar with certain cultural things and be held accountable
mm-hmm.
for what you're perceiving as disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I am working with a leader one-on-one and doing professional development like that, then I get to see, because I can see those suspension numbers go down. I can see people pausing and assessing what's really happening in this moment. And am I having a subconscious response where I automatically assume that the Black child is doing something wrong? Or can I take a breath and say, what's really happening in this classroom overall? So I do get to see some of the benefits of that work.
Wow. You're just making me think about things that transcend even the direct conversation we're having. When I first moved my family from Michigan down here to in fake Florida, we're more Southern Alabama than we are real Florida. And it is considered to be disrespectful if a child does not address an adult with sir or ma'am. And my parents, my kids had never experienced that before. And they were seen as disrespectful because they didn't finish sentences with sir or ma'am. And it blew my mind that that simple layer was missed and it was seen as disrespectful. My child, one of my kids was suspended from school one day because he killed a spider in class. And it was that teacher's belief that killing a spider was disrespectful because in their classroom, they simply capture living creatures and let them go outside. It's a simple example, but it's another example of when your values don't align with somebody else's values, you start to look as one is right and one is wrong. And there are consequences associated with behaving incorrectly in somebody else's perception because we want to try to make sure that you can assimilate to our values, to our way of doing things so that we can perpetuate it. And it's the reality. That is what we do.
And what other than white supremacy decided that white culture was right? Who says?
Boom.
Just because that's what we've been taught does not mean that that is right. I think the two examples that you just gave are great. And now can we multiply that by a million and understand that that's happening to Black children in schools all the time. But yeah. The challenge comes in is that when they hear the term a Black child being disrespectful, they, because of what the media tells us, they automatically think that that child cursed a teacher out.
Right.
What? We don't, because there's a disrespect, it's a range.
Right.
Right. And so that's another example of like it's the taxation that we carry, and people don't ask enough questions. They make assumptions about us, again, because the media has said that Black children are disrespectful, that they are poor, that they're this. And it's just like, I'm just so over it. And like I said, in this information age, we as the adults have to make a choice to inquire and do our own learning so that this can stop.
That's good. I'm going to ask you maybe two more questions. But as people are listening to this, I hope that they're understanding that the work is really on them. As they're listening to this, hopefully you're triggering them to pause and do some reflection or to think or some journaling. And then hopefully those thoughts will lead to transformative actions and changes in behavior. So if you're driving in your car right now, I want you to really get yourself deep into the thought and think, how do you fit into this conversation? Whether you're a man or woman, whether you're white or you're Black, wherever you fit into this, you're part of this system that we're saying needs some sort of structural overhaul. So what is your part in that? And I want you to think that through and start to process where you are, where you want to go, and what changes you want to see happen. But before you get to that, I want to give you, Nadia, this opportunity to, I call it the mic drop moment, where you've got people listening who have been captivated by all of these things, and they might be completely overwhelmed. They might be thinking, this is too big for me. Who am I to fix this system that has been in place like this for hundreds of years? I'm just this little bitty person. It's not, I just want to worry about my family. I just want to worry about my kids. I just want to worry about my neighborhood, my community, my city. This is bigger than me. And they don't necessarily know where they fit, but yet they're listening to your words. They're resonating with them, but they don't know where to go. You know, if you were standing in front of them and you had a microphone in your hand and you're about to drop it, and you want to leave them with something, what would be your mic drop moment that you would leave people with?
Do an assessment of your life and take responsibility for any ways that you may have perpetuated racist systems, racist beliefs that may be contributing to the oppression of people that don't look like you. And so when I say do an assessment of your life in that, have I read books written by authors of color? Do my children see, artwork? Or do they read books by people of color? Do my children have Black friends? Not that doesn't make you racist. Let's be clear, because that term is used. How can I be racist? I have a Black friend. I'm not saying that doesn't. This is an all-encompassing expansion, because that's frustrating. But like, this is.
I'm married. Just to put this out there, I'm married, but I still have sexist beliefs. So I'll just throw that out there. So
thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot. But it's an all-encompassing to what extent are you even exposing your children and yourself to things outside of what you believe, how you were raised, et cetera? And you're gonna help yourself. Like, we are to be more open to knowing more people, understanding people, doing your individual work, that helps you to transform and do your internal work as an individual. Mm. Right? There, 10 years ago, I couldn't have this conversation with you. I was so angry about what I was experiencing and what I was seeing on a regular basis. I would not have had the energy or the patience to sit down to have this conversation with you. I had to realize that I have a platform and I have an opportunity for influence.
Yes.
And if I'm going to shift mindsets and transform people, I had to do my work. And so just start with yourself, assess your life. How am I engaging with people at work? What am I afraid of? Have I believed certain things about people of color? And mm-hmm. do those beliefs, you know, attribute to why I don't surround myself with X people, et cetera, right? Do my friendship groups believe certain things? Do my parents believe certain things? Maybe you don't say the N-word, but you were raised in a house where your grandfather said the N-word I know lots of my white colleagues have told me that it's even hard for them to go to holidays anymore because their grandparents still say racist things. I know that happens. But then how are you being intentional about removing yourself from that environment or educating others in that environment? Hmm. So if everyone would take up the mantle of their self-work, and not the performative, but the true self-work, that's the place to start.
Yeah.
And then as you truly dive into that work, you will grow just as you have. Like, you will grow and you will want to influence more and you will want to be more positive and spread your knowledge to others. But it all starts with us.
That's it. Do your work in front of the mirror, not in front of the camera, right? I know there are some of us that we took the pictures because we wanted everybody else to know where we stood. But then that's, again, us focusing more on the external things to make ourselves seem more self-righteous than others, as opposed to that missionary planting the seeds. Do your work, have those critical conversations, poke the bear if necessary, continue to dig deep and engage in the conversation. I'm a big believer that transformation has no taboo topic. So dig deep and have the conversations that matter most. Otherwise, everybody will continue to live within their own bubble. You'll continue to go on social media where the algorithm is programmed for you to only see people that think like you, that believe like you, that hold the same political beliefs as you. And you're going to think the world exists just like you. Step outside of your phone. Step outside of your camera. Step into the real world. Find somebody that doesn't look like you. Find somebody that doesn't believe what you believe and start talking. And that's where it starts. That's where it starts. Not if people want to reach out to you and continue this conversation, if they want to reach out to you and say, hey, can you guide me through some of this reflective work? Can you coach me? Can you help my system? Can you help my team? How can they reach out to you?
Absolutely. So on Instagram, it's at Wynn Brown Girls Lead. They can also go to NadiaBennett.com/podcast, and they will be able to sign up for a weekly newsletter. My email information will be there as well. And on LinkedIn, it's Nadia A. Bennett.
Beautiful. And all those things are linked down in the show notes. So maybe the first piece of work that you want to do is actually scroll down and look at the show notes that you always skip over. So go down and look at the show notes and find ways to connect with Nadia. She will help you start the transformational process. She's not going to change you. She's not going to transform you. That's on you. But she can stand beside you and ask you those deep questions that get you to start thinking, is this the work that you need? Nadia, I appreciate you. I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate the change that you're bringing about in this generation and the next generation. You're truly changing destinies. It starts with people like us sitting down and having the conversations, but it trickles down to the kids, to the youth, and then their kids, who hopefully will enter the world with a system unlike the systems that we're currently living in. So thank you so much for all that you do and for just taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
Thank you for checking out this episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. Your support means the world to me. I would love to continue to connect with you. Feel free to reach out to me at Dave Schmidto on all the things, connect with me online at schmitto.net or shoot me an email, david.schmitto@gmail.com.